Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, as France extends the detention of the founder of Telegram, should owners of social media platforms be held legally responsible for what's on them? We speak to the European Commission. Also, the oil market is volatile after Libya halts almost all its oil exports. IKEA tests out a new site to help people who want to part with their IKEA furniture. The CEO of the main operator of IKEA stores tells me why.
We are interested to understand which type of products go secondhand, which not. What are the most common problems and so forth. So it's also a way for us to reconnect with customers.
And we look at what aging populations mean for countries like China. But first, Pavel Durov, the Russian-born founder of the messaging app Telegram, is to stay in French custody at least until Wednesday, French prosecutors say. They're investigating crimes related to child pornography, drug trafficking, and fraudulent transactions on the platform. Under pressure over what Russia's called a political arrest, President Macron wrote on X, "This is in no way a political decision. It's up to the judges to decide." But what should we read into the detention of the owner of an app? Is this a new hard line in dealing with social media? Is it a blow against free speech, in fact? The European Union has a Digital Services Act, asserting the need to prevent illegal and harmful activities online and the spread of disinformation. But how does that apply here? Well, I asked Thomas Regnier, who's European Commission spokesperson on the digital economy.
It is not for the Commission to comment on a national investigation, which is based under national criminal law. So here, basically, the arrest that took place in France, so of CEO Pavel Durov, is under the competence of the French authorities. And the arrest seems to be conducted under French criminal law. Of course, we're closely monitoring the developments related to Telegram, and we stand ready to cooperate with the French authorities should it be relevant. Because, of course, the Telegram is regulated in the EU under the Digital Services Act.
So, therefore, it comes within your competence, obviously. But what about the wider question of taking action against the leaders, the owners of social media platforms or messaging apps? Is that something that is a way forward in terms of dealing with the problems that there clearly are with these apps?
Well, we have a slightly different approach because criminal prosecution is not among the potential sanctions for breach of the Digital Services Act. What we focus on is on the platforms themselves. And what we ask platforms to do very concretely, and all online platforms, including Telegram, have to comply with these obligations since February of this year, is to simply act against illegal content. For example, they now, all the platforms, have to provide means to users to flag potentially illegal content. And as soon as platforms are aware of it, they need to remove it. It's as simple as it is.
I understand that, obviously. But part of what is being alleged against Pavel Durov is that his platform did not take action against content of the kind you're describing. Is that a way forward, do you think, in terms of action against these platforms to look at the regulations that they put in place? And if, for example, they don't adhere to the regulations you've been talking about, would criminal prosecution by member countries be a way forward?
Well, this is for the countries to determine. What we do here in the EU, I mean, we have clear rules and we have a staggered implementation, if you want, of the DSA. All platforms that reach more than 45 million users in the EU, so it's 10% of the EU population, they fall under the shared competence of national authorities and the European Commission. We have designated so far 25 of these very large online platforms. They fall under our competence and we're closely monitoring how they enforce the DSA and if they comply with EU legislation on terrorist content, on illegal content, generally speaking, on disinformation, on other societal risks, such as the protection of minors. Now, Telegram, because we're talking here about Telegram specifically, they declared reaching 41 million users in the EU. So currently, they are under the threshold for designation, which means that for the moment, for the national authorities to implement the DSA and to supervise that the DSA is properly enforced by Telegram.
That's very interesting. You're saying they're under the threshold. But let me quote to you what Telegram have said in reaction to the arrest of Pavel Durov. They said they abide by European Union laws and their moderation is within industry standards and constantly improving. Would you say that was right?
Well, I wouldn't comment on that specifically because, as I said, Telegram currently is under the threshold, so it's not the Commission directly supervising and enforcing the DSA towards that platform. But what is for sure, what needs to happen is that the DSA requires so platforms to provide users with means to flag illegal content, as I've just said, but as well to cooperate with national authorities. And this is what Telegram also has to do, like all other platforms, including when these national authorities ask the platforms to take actions or to when they receive orders to provide information on accounts suspected of criminal activity, for example. So, of course, national authorities currently have a competence to enforce legislation, and it's, again, within their competence to take such such criminal prosecutions. It's not for the Commission to do so.
Okay, let me read you out one more part from the statement from Telegram, because it's interesting to get the principle, establish whether the principle is one you acknowledge. They say it is absurd to claim that a platform or its owner are responsible for abuse of that platform. Would you agree with that?
I agree in that sense that, of course, it's not for a platform to monitor every individual type of content that is going on its platform. It's impossible to do. Otherwise, these platforms wouldn't operate in the EU if we asked them to do so. And it's the same for the Commission. It's impossible for us to flag and to monitor every individual type of content running out there, be it legal or illegal. So this is exactly why we asked, under the DSA, platforms to provide users with tools to flag illegal content when they're confronted with it, when they see it on their feed. And the platform only needs to act when such illegal content is flagged to the platform. As soon as it's notified, it has the obligation to act. This is what we ask platforms to do.
Thomas Regnier there of the European Commission. Well, there's several questions that arise from that, I guess, in terms of how the platforms are regulated, to what extent they can be held responsible, at least for putting up these flags, as he put it, on them. Mark McCarthy is with the Communications, Culture and Technology Program at Georgetown University in the US and author of the book Regulating Digital Industries, How Public Oversight Can Encourage Competition, Protect Privacy and Ensure Free Speech. He joins me now. Mark McCarthy, thanks for being with us. It is interesting there that Thomas Regnier of the European Commission was saying they don't expect platforms to actually monitor all the content that is on the platforms. But unless you have that kind of regulation, then things like what the French are alleging what happened with Telegram are bound to arise.
Oh, thanks for having me. You raised a good point that somebody has to be monitoring these systems. But it simply cannot be the platforms themselves. There's too much material on there. So the European Union has set out a very reasonable approach, which I call notice liability. That is, the platforms are not liable unless they know about the illegal material on their systems. And that basically means unless they have been, if they haven't been notified about the illegal material, then they're not responsible for it. Once they get a notification, however, then they're potentially liable if they do nothing. So they find something on the system that they've been notified about, and they say, I guess I'll do nothing about this. If they do nothing about it at that point, and it turns out really to be illegal, it could be terrorist material, for example, then they are liable for having that material on their system.
Do you think that is what's going on potentially with Telegram? Because the French say that they are investigating these things that have gone on the platform. And Telegram famously is very much a hands-off in terms of what it does with what's on the platform. Do you think that's at the core of what's going on with Pavel Durov?
They claim that they are in compliance with the DSA. And that would mean that they would respond to these notifications when they got them. What the French law is in this case, we don't know because no one has officially spoken out yet to tell us what exactly it is that Telegram has been alleged to be in violation of. It is possible that France has a law that says if you don't take down the system, the illegal material when you're notified about it, then you are liable. But they haven't cited that law if it exists. And until we know more about it, it's just really a mystery what's going on with the French action.
I suppose, Mark, there's a wider point in this, which has caused a lot of interest, because a lot of countries, I mean, Britain, during the recent rioting, obviously had reason perhaps to be somewhat, certainly the government, concerned about what was going on with X and its owner, Elon Musk. And now the owner of a particular app has been arrested. I mean, is this a signal of things to come, that people will be held accountable in this way at the very highest level?
Well, the users have always been liable, and that's really what was going on in the UK recently. If you post something online and it's illegal, it's defamatory or it's terrorist material or it's an incitement to violence, you are responsible for that. The question is, under what circumstances the platform is responsible? And we'll see whether the French are pushing that issue. We don't know yet. It's certainly possible that they are elevating this issue to make it more likely that companies will be held responsible if they fail to take down illegal material after being notified.
Oh, well, it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out, Mark. I'm sure we'll come back to you. Thank you so much for being with us. Mark McCarthy there of Georgetown University. Now, oil prices around the world rose by about 3% on Monday as investors focused on supply concerns. And this time, it's not just fears of a regional war in the Middle East involving Israel and Iran. Libya, one of the main suppliers of crude, is shutting down most of its oil fields right now. The reason is the ongoing dispute between rival governments in the east and the west of that country. The eastern-based administration said on Monday it was shutting down the oil fields and terminals that it controls and suspending production. Libya produces about 1.2 million barrels per day. So this is a far from insignificant move. Joining me now is Matt Smith, who's lead oil analyst for the Americas at Kepler, and joins us on the line from Louisville, Kentucky. Matt, thanks for being with us. First of all, what did happen with oil prices today?
Well, as you said, Roger, we saw them running much stronger, both on a Brent basis, on a WTI basis as well, that US benchmark. We got about 3% tacked onto prices there. And so, as you said, you know, we had a weekend of disruptions here, or escalation in terms of the Middle East. You know, we had Israel and Hezbollah firing missiles at each other. But it's really this supply concern and the uncertainty surrounding that has really caused prices to get a really solid ramp up to start the week here.
And Libya, what I mean, in ballpark terms, what's going on? Is it the dispute, and is the oil likely to come back on stream anytime soon?
Well, we're not actually 100% sure that it's all coming off. There's the threat that this is being done. But the challenge that we have, Roger, is we've got this blueprint just from back in 2020, when the Eastern government, this Libyan National Army led by General Haftar, he blockaded the ports, and we saw Libyan crude exports absolutely crater. And that's one of the unique things that you see about Libya, in that they export the vast majority of the production. They're not keeping very much back for themselves. They don't need that much for demand or for refining. And so when you see their production getting hit, it reflects itself through into those exports really rather swiftly. And so the concern here is that if, as and when we do get some type of shut-ins, we will see that showing up very quickly in the real-time data in terms of a lack of supply hitting the market.
And another interesting move on the oil front today was to do with the US building up its stockpile. What's that about?
With the which stockpile is this?
Well, well, there are many stockpiles, as you know, but basically building up its resilience, I suppose, is what we're talking about, the ability to respond to these kind of things by making sure they have enough.
Well, we've had a situation in the US over the last few years where the US has had 600 million barrels in its strategic oil reserves, the strategic petroleum reserve it's called. But when the Ukraine-Russia conflict started, the Biden administration drew that down by 250 million barrels. Now what they're trying to do is start eking barrels back into that, but it's just doing less than 1 million barrels a week. And so you can imagine, to replace that strategic reserve by less than 1 million barrels a week is going to take an awfully long time. But fortunately, the last thing I'd add on that is that the US still has over 400 million barrels in its commercial inventories. It produces 13.5 million barrels a day as well, so that it's got basically supply ready to pull out the ground any day. So The situation for the US is much better than elsewhere.
And briefly, Matt, I guess it gives them the advantage there when it comes to making up for the Libyan shortfall as far as Europe is concerned, for example.
My gosh, yeah, the US is best placed to help fill that gap, mostly because of the type of crude. The type of crude from Libya is very high quality, so it is low in sulfur, and it's light sweet, basically, yeah. And that's the same as US crude, so it'll be able to backfill, it would seem.
Right, Matt, thank you very much for making all that really clear. Matt Smith there of Kepler. Now, let's talk about the oil market as well and how it affected the share markets today. Deanna Gutter, Behavioural and Financial Advisor at Brighton Securities, joins on the line. Deanna, thanks for being with us. First of all, I mean, oil was volatile. I guess a lot of people trying to weigh up what all these various things happening in the Middle East, whether it's Libya or, I suppose, or the wider regional war, potentially, what that might mean.
Exactly. Always nice talking with you, Roger. Thanks for having me again. And that's exactly what investors are looking at, the broader conflict in the Middle East, how it affects oil. Crude oil's up 3%. When we think about it, you mentioned earlier in conversation with Matt, the closure of all oil fields in sections of Libya is huge. But where are people in Europe going to get their oil? Well, they're going to get it from the U.S., hence ours is up 3%.
Yeah, you could kind of understand how that works in that way. But let's look at the wider markets a bit, Deanna, because it was interesting that we've seen quite a lot of volatility over the summer in the share markets generally, to put it mildly. And that's, of course, low volumes because people are away. So small moves make big effects. But it was interesting, the S&P is certainly retreating at the moment, isn't it?
It is. It is a little bit, you know, and the Dow hit a new level today. But both the S&P and NASDAQ pulled back because of technology shares. We're getting our chip stocks, and including NVIDIA, which we're going to hear reports on Wednesday, they're pulling back the tech.
Yeah, I mean, NVIDIA is really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, that was so much the poster child earlier in the year, and it was, you know, the leading everything. So what are we expecting? Because it's the quarterly report coming up.
Right, it's quarterly report, and they could have the revenues they're expecting. They might even double. But think about this. The past three quarters, their growth has exceeded 200%. So, I mean, come on, investors got to be thinking, how long can this last, right? Or how long can the customers pump money into NVIDIA for orders? And then I think sometimes people think, you know, hey, look, there is an economic slowdown, and maybe I'll take my earnings that I already got from the tech stocks, or maybe I'll just scale down in my technology sectors and in my own investing.
Yeah, it's clearly a lot of calculations of that kind going on. And you mentioned about, you know, potentially a slowdown more generally. And, of course, there's a great deal of talk about that ever since, of course, the Jackson Hole. And we heard from the head of the Fed and everything he was saying about the potential for future interest rate cuts. Now we just heard from the San Francisco Fed president, Mary Daly. She's really pushing for cuts in interest rates as well. So it's kind of a done deal now, isn't it?
It is. They're all saying it's time, right? The time has come. The time to adjust is upon us. Okay, it's time. So they're really looking at two things. You know, the economy's slowing down. One thing is inflation. They're getting that under control. The other is the job market, right? So we're going to look at a 25 basis point. In September, lower.
Yep. If anything can be certain, it's not certain. Anything's very likely in these circumstances. I think we can probably say that. Deanna, thank you so much for being with us, Deanna.
Thanks, Roger.
Get her there. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, this week on World Business Report, we're going to be exploring the challenges countries face due to an increase in older population groups. Now, here's a sample of what we're going to be talking about, starting with a farmer in Kenya who's too old to tend his crops alone.
It is me who grew these crops and I tend to them. I try and motivate myself to carry out the work that is needed here on the farm, but because I'm on my own, it is difficult.
68 next month.
And you, Ali?
I will be 65 in about 4 weeks. Part of the success of a factory would be having a good age range mix. We can pass on the skills to the younger generation.
I mean, naturally, people want to retire at early age and enjoy their life. But from economics perspective, it's not sustainable. And that is going to become a very heavy burden for the government.
And as this batch of seniors dances to Bollywood hits at the end of their tour, can India keep pace with the needs of its aging population?
The BBC's Arunade Mukherjee there, reporting from India, where business is trying to benefit from the greater numbers of people retiring than before. You also heard from the UK and Singapore, and we'll hear more of those stories coming up. But what is it like in a country that was the most populous on Earth? China lost that spot to India, but still around 1.4 billion. The age profile, however, is moving in the wrong direction, in part because of the one-child policy the country used to have. There were fewer girls, and as a result, so fewer women to bear children later. CUGN Peng of the Centre of Policy Studies at Victoria University in Melbourne told me what was projected for China's population in the decades to come.
China's population began to decline in 2022, and this trend will continue into 2023. So we expect this population decline will continue throughout this century. And the declining rate will accelerate unless China's fertility can be increased rapidly.
Is this because, really, of what happened with the one-child policy? Is that what's led to this?
Yeah, one-child policy definitely is one of very important factors to contribute to China's current low fertility rate. But there are still other factors, such as rapid economic growth, when people's income become higher, and also women's education. Women get more education, and also women have more chance to working. So all those factors contribute to the decline of the fertility rate.
And I guess this is going to have an effect on China's economic growth ambitions when the population is going in this way, because there are more elderly people living longer and they have to be supported.
Oh, yes, you are very right. The fertility decline normally accompanies by this population aging, because we have the smaller number of children born every year. The implication is, from short term, we can see downward pressure on consumption spending. And also, in the longer term, we think China's labor force declined since 2014. The negative labor growth means we definitely slow down China's economic growth.
CUGN Peng there. Now, IKEA is one of the world's best-known furniture retailers. You know, flat-pack bookshelves you buy at a huge out-of-town store and then struggle to put together when you get them home. Well, now it seems the Swedish brand is branching out into something a bit different. They're trying to get in on what happens when people want to sell their bookcases. And they're trying out IKEA Pre-Owned, a website where customers can sell on their furniture second-hand. Now, they say they want to help consumers recycle their goods. I asked Jesper Brodin, chief executive at Inka, which operates IKEA's stores, why they were doing this.
What we know from our studies is that the IKEA products, actually, interesting enough, represent a higher market share in the secondhand market than firsthand, so to speak. So we are about 10% market share. A lot of people in special life situations, like living with children, students and so on, keep the furniture for a while and then they want to change. So it's trading with people. The big idea for us is basically to offer extra value added as they want to trade with others.
So the way it's going to work, as I understand it, you have a kind of website, people can advertise, put their things on that website, and yeah, you effectively are bringing together the buyer and the seller, is that right?
We are. It's similar to an ordinary platform for secondhand, with the exception that what we do is we add an opportunity of simplicity. You scan your product and you will have AI-generated content with measurements, materials, pictures of the product. We also give the customers the opportunity. We basically recommend the price for them so they don't have to do too much research. And on the buyer side, we also offer them opportunities for spare parts and other things. So we think we actually add a value what the other platforms don't do.
But where's the value for you?
Basically, it is an experiment. We are still testing this. We're testing it in Madrid. We're testing it in Oslo. But we think we will learn a lot about customers' needs. But it's also an important part of our climate strategy that we actually enhance and prolong the life of our products. So if we can contribute to that business, it's good for us in totality.
But what you're saying is data, essentially. You want to know the habits of the buyers and sellers. It's data. You can sell the data.
Well, we don't sell the data, but we are interested to understand which type of products go secondhand, which not. What are the most common problems and so forth. We are also testing commercial angle to it, where we offer people, if you don't want to trade in the money straight away between buyer and seller, we're actually giving you an opportunity to, we up the amount by 50% if you come to IKEA. So it's also a way for us to reconnect with customers.
Yeah. You might get a cut, I suppose, in the end. Are you going to take a commission? Are you going to get a small fee? How's that going to work?
In the testing phase, we're actually testing to do it for free. I wouldn't rule out to charge something. So there is a certain cost with the platform that we are trying to figure out right now. But in any case, the idea is not to make a lot of money on this trade. It was more to maybe cover the cost in that respect. But for now, it's actually free.
You know very well that eBay is out there, Craigslist, Gumtree. I mean, they're all doing this already. Why do you need to be there?
The only reason for us to be there is that we actually can offer more data to customers. We can offer them opportunities with pictures, with measurements, with material and content. So when you place your product on the IKEA pre-owned site, you will wrap it in information that makes the sale much better. And then I would say, by offering, as we do right now, free of charge, in many places, that's quite unique as well.
But Mr. Broden, I mean, one of the things that, as you'll know, places like eBay do is they do a kind of verification. There's that you can be assured about the people you're dealing with on it. Are you going to verify the customers on this?
The verification, they will be following the strictest principles of all the platforms out there, really. So
you will be doing verification,
for us,
definitely.
To make sure we protect, of course, the security of our customers.
Right. Okay. So you'll follow the normal lines that eBay or whatever would do in terms of that and security. And would the money pass directly between buyer and seller, or does it come via you?
Basically, the money passes between the seller or the buyer, or if you choose the option of engaging with IKEA, then we will give you an opportunity to top up the amount with 50% if you come by one of the IKEA stores.
Is this because, in a way, you're trying to change the profile of IKEA now? It's not just, you know, someplace on the outskirts of big towns you go and get some put-together furniture. You're trying a different route, perhaps?
It's not an image question, so to say. So IKEA is sincerely committed to the Paris Agreement. We are well underway, actually. Since Paris was signed, we have grown the business by 31% and reduced carbon with 24%. And that means, you know, we are addressing production, materials, life at home, retailing, transport, all aspects of climate. And secondhand is just one of the important parts of that. So by engaging in this, we know that we're going to make a difference into the climate footprint of IKEA, but we also think there might be some business upside on it.
Jesper Broden there of Inca. And that's it from World Business Report. Bye-bye.